This is Arrivals. Stories of migration, transformation, and change. The program that explores what we do when what we've done is a thing of the past. Nothing defines life more than death. Still, it's amazing to me how rarely we talk about it. Perhaps it's one of the reasons why a brush with death can completely alter the course of a single person's life. Today on Arrivals, we hear a story of survival unlike any that you've heard before.
My name is Katie McKenna, and I grew up in a town called Manhasset, New York, just about 20 minutes outside of the city. I grew up with two brothers and a sister and a really wonderful mom and dad, just typical suburban upbringing, and then moved to Williamsburg in Brooklyn. So North Williamsburg, or Williamsburg, kind of what people would say proper, is very, very hip, like full of great coffee shops and fancy grocery stores and beautiful restaurants and great bars and impossibly chic people, like people who could make wearing like a $10 suit look impeccable. I just don't know how they were able to do it. But the difference between there and East Williamsburg was just that it was a little bit less populated. It was closer to the housing projects, closer to where there was like the industrial zone kind of started about four blocks away from where I lived. And that was where there were shipping companies and there were t-shirt companies and all these different things that you would have no idea what they did. This was a little bit more isolated, I guess would be a good way to describe it. On October 2nd, I woke up early. I usually would do either a 10-mile bike ride or a 5-mile run. And that morning, I knew that I just started a new job about a month ago, and I was still really nervous about it, was working in finance. I was a theater major working in finance, which was hilarious and ridiculous. But I was able to act like I knew what I was doing, but I was still very nervous about where I was in the world and how I would kind of get through it. And the evening before, I had actually gotten into a really bad fight with my boyfriend at the time, and we were just fighting about nothing. And it was one of those mornings where I woke up and I was just like, I need to sweat this off. I just need to sweat off these nerves. I need to sweat off this fight. I felt embarrassed sort of about the way that I had behaved and was still sort of angry. And I decided that I would go and maybe take a bike ride. It felt like a good bike ride morning. It was about 6, and it was one of those like very beginning of fall feeling mornings where everything just is crisp and so beautiful. And I always feel like it's like the first gulp of ice water, you know, that it just, everything felt so clean and perfect and good. And I really was enjoying the ride, and I just finished up about like 8 or 9 miles, and I got to my apartment and I saw that the sun was starting to rise, you know, further in the industrial area. So I was like, okay, well, I'll just finish up this ride in the most perfect way. I will just greet this day and be excited and know that it's a fresh start. I went down the block to down Mass Bath Avenue, where my apartment was, and I stopped at the light, and just around these low brick buildings, the sun was rising, and I was like, oh my gosh, this is gonna be the best. So I stop at the light, and on my left is a truck, and I wave to it, and I wave in the side view mirror, and then I you know, say that I'm turning right, and then the Mazda behind me, I told them I was turning right. Both of them didn't have their indicators on, so they were both going straight. And I thought I kind of had it made in the shade, so I went, as soon as the light turned, I made this wide right turn, and on my left, I heard a rumbling, and the truck was going. It was going right, and I could feel like almost like the heat of the engine, and I heard it coming close to me, and then the truck kind of knocked me over on my side, and then I missed the cab by inches, but I was run over by the first four wheels of the truck, and I was conscious during it, so I watched them as they rolled over my body. And I still had the bike tangled up in my knees and my legs. And I saw as the, I knew, I wasn't sure if the truck was gonna stop or not. I don't know if they knew I was there. And the only thing that I could think to do was to clench my abdominal muscles in hopes of saving my organs. Because I just, it was like an amazing thing that your body does to try to save itself. And I did. And then the next four wheels came and I felt the air of the mud flaps like over my face. And it was just terrifying because it was like I was in an action movie. And I was like, nobody survives this. People say, I feel like I got run over by a truck, but nobody gets run over by a truck. That doesn't happen. And there I was, laid out in the gravel, like on the asphalt, with my gear shift had went into the side of my body and had twisted, and I couldn't even look down at myself because I just knew it was too horrifying. And then when I realized that I was alive and that I was blinking and I was breathing, I just started to scream. And I remember screaming and asking for my mom, which is just such an incredible thing. You know, you're 24 and you think that you're independent and you're capable, and but everybody always just wants their mom. Luckily, there was a woman named Giselle and her boyfriend who were in the Mazda. They had flares in the back of their car and they created a way to block traffic around me. And Giselle called 911 and she asked me if I knew my mother's phone number or my family's phone number. And I remembered my home phone number and my mother's cell phone number. And so they were able to call them. My mom was dropping my dad off at the train to go into the city. So they didn't get it. My mom had left her cell phone at home because it was only a mile and a half drive. But I heard how terrified this woman was. She was so scared. And I was like, holy shit, this is so real. Like, she's scared because this is not going to be easily fixed. This is not an easy thing. And that was super scary. That almost made it more real. They called the ambulance, and this woman, Giselle, I stayed conscious the whole time. And I had this thing in my mind that if I didn't blink, then I wouldn't die. Like, I had it in my mind that if I kept my eyes open, then I wouldn't die. Because, you know, I've seen films. People, when they die, they close their eyes, you know. It was such a basic idea, but it was the only part of my body that didn't hurt was my eyelids. So I just kept them open so wide. And I just remember that blue sky as it turned from, you know, that twilighty inky blue to like the lighter blue, because it was that sunrise that I was chasing was starting to light up the sky. And it was really beautiful. And I kept on drinking it in because I was like, this could be it, kiddo. Like, you better get in as much beauty as you can. But I kept my eyes open, and Giselle, actually, she was amazing. She held my hand and she prayed the Our Father. She like prayed with me. And interesting, the craziest thing that happened was that I was there on the gravel and I saw a car pull over and stop. And it was an old Camry, Toyota Camry. And a man came out, he was Hispanic, probably in his 40s, with a Madras shirt and khaki cargo pants, wearing a New York Yankees hat. And he came right over, and I was thinking to myself, like, in hindsight, I'm like, I would be terrified to walk over to somebody like that. And he came over, and he took my hand, and he said, listen to me. I am a pastor. I have spoken to God, and you are not going to die today. And I asked him, I said, do you promise? And he said, I promise. And that was the only hope that I had was just that man. After he left was when the ambulance came, and interestingly enough, I had been told by my best friend, who is a nurse, that you have patients' rights, and I was really nervous about the hospital that's the closest to here, and I was like, if I go there, I'm gonna die. The hospital that's the closest to here, to where I lived, was a New York State run, a city run hospital that they're incredibly understaffed, and they see the worst of the worst in the neighborhood, that so many people come in with gunshot wounds and drug addictions, and it's just the service is not what one would hope. And I knew that my injuries were really, really bad. And I knew that if I went there, I would die. And I was absolutely sure that I would die. And when the ambulance came, I was like, I have patients' rights. Can you imagine a girl with tire tracks on her body being like, I have patients' rights? It's like, come on. But I was like, I have patients' rights. I'm not going there. I'm not going to the closest hospital. You need to take me to the best hospital. And the EMTs were like, looking at me like, you're going to die anyway. You know, really. And I was like, you have to take me. These other people heard me. You have to take me. And you have to take me to the best trauma hospital. And they said, that's Elmhurst. That's in Queens. And I was like, I don't care. Take me there. It's an amazing thing what the brain and body do. It really is. It is amazing that my brain really didn't want to die. Like, whatever it was inside of me did not want to die and was willing to do anything in my tiny little arsenal of capabilities. The fact that I pulled that out of my mind is unbelievable to me now. It's like, there'd be no way. And that was, in actuality, like, I sometimes wonder, I'm like, did I really? But it's like, yeah, no, you wouldn't be going to like the best trauma hospital in the city if you didn't say that. So they were so unused to going to Elmhurst that on the way there, they got lost. They had to stop and ask for directions. And I'm in the back of the ambulance going, I'm gonna kill myself. And I was like, bitch, you're already dying. Like, you know, it's like, because you toss around that kind of language, you know, I'm gonna kill myself. It's like, no, you're dying. So I have no idea what was going through their minds. But I just remember we were speeding along and then we stopped. And I knew we were stopped and that it took an unbelievable amount of time. Living in New York for all of my life, basically, I knew how far it was from Williamsburg to Elmhurst, and it was not this long. Like, even in my messed up state, I had a sense of being like, this is not reasonable. So yeah, then we do get to the hospital, and then once we're at the hospital, I asked the doctor, you know, they're rolling me in, and there was a doctor, and I asked her, I was like, am I gonna die? And she said, I'm not sure. It's not looking good. Then, you know, I've been crying the whole time, but I just cried harder. I was like so grateful that I was conscious, because I said, you know, can you please tell my parents that I love them? Tell my brothers and my sister that I love them. Tell my friends, please tell my boyfriend I'm sorry about the fight. Just tell them that I'm sorry and that I love them. And then I went into 10 hours of emergency surgery. I remember them putting the mask on me, and I said the Hail Mary. I said the Hail Mary instead of counting, and I just said it out loud. And I remember that really well, and I remember watching my breath fog up that mask. I just remember watching it and being like, this could be the last thing that you ever see. I had only blinked about 40 times, because I counted from the time I got run over until I got into the hospital, because I was so afraid of dying. And I remember that. I was like, okay, you don't have any more control. Just gotta let it go. There's not a ton you can do here. So I just exhaled and I let it go. I remember, it's not as if like my life didn't flash before my eyes. I
I just remember feeling like profoundly grateful for it, but absolutely desperate for more. Like I felt that feeling of almost like when you're starving and all that you can think about is like that next meal, when you're so thirsty and you just like dream about a glass of water. I was like, I just want more. I know I can do more. I just want like a little bit more.
My mother and father and my brothers and my sister, were both at college, and I guess they'd taken buses down. They were all around the bed, and I was intubated, and I had oxygen, but I had a tube down my throat. And I remember seeing them, and I couldn't really move my hands very well, but my parents were waving and just crying, and my mom squeezed my toe and she's like, "Hi, baby." And they were all so sad. And my father was crying, and my father doesn't cry. I kind of had hoped that if my parents were there, then I could go home. I don't know why. I just thought they'd like, you know, wrap me up with an ACE bandage and everything would be okay. And obviously there was no way for me to go home. I was there for a long time after that. It was very confusing. I think that especially because I had lived in a world of yes as a, you know, upper middle class white woman, everything had been yes. I was in my mid-20s. I'd found a job relatively easily. I had, you know, I had everything that I wanted. And suddenly it was no, you can't walk. No, you're not leaving. I sustained a lot of internal injuries that they weren't, because it was so close to my diaphragm that they were worried that my diaphragm would fill up with blood and I would choke on my own blood and die. And I think I knew then that there's a reason why they're sitting vigil. Like, I kind of was like, okay. I think it was after the fourth day. I remember, like, after the first or second or third day, I was like, okay, this makes sense. They need to just make sure I'm all right. And I've gone in for a couple more surgeries. But on the fourth day, I was like, I'm not going anywhere. This is what my life is. This is what my life is going to be. Because I'm not well. Like there is, and I don't know what well is. I don't know how healthy I need to be because I know that I'm really far from that. And I was so terrified. I was so scared of not being in control, of not knowing what exactly needed to be fixed, and of not being able to fix it myself. And I think that that was... And also, having legs are the best, and not being able to walk is so sad. It is just, it is a very, very sad business. And to know that there was the potential that this could be the rest of my life was so devastating. It really just knocked me sideways. My pelvis had been fractured in 5 places, and I broke all of my ribs and punctured my lung and tore up a few of my organs. And my feet hadn't touched the floor in about a month. It's interesting, they told me that your muscles, every week that you don't move, you lose 1 year's worth of muscle mass. So I'd lost like my legs were, I used to be able to run a mile in 5 minutes and 18 seconds back in the day. And my legs were bones. Like it was just very, very, very tough. Really hard for me, I think, especially as like an athletically minded person to know how weak I was. And the reason why I fought really hard to walk again was because I just couldn't imagine the idea of letting my family down, of putting them in the position of having their hearts broken again in that way. My father, when he would leave at night, every night, he would, you know, say, "I love you." And then he'd be like, "Listen, kid, you're in the corner.
and you're in the fight of your life. He's like, I know you're getting beat up. I know it. He's like, but you just got to keep punching, okay? Just don't give up. Just, you got to keep punching. And that was sort of what I took into physical therapy was, it's not going to be pretty. It's not going to be perfect. But I have to really, really try. Because it's not for me. It's for my family. It's for the people who love me, who have been through hell and back watching me go through this. Like, I have to really, really try. Because they deserve that. I do my best to try to make it not for much of public consumption, to keep it kind of light as getting run over by a truck is, but that I try to keep it as a past thing versus what it is truly, which is something that lives in me every minute of every day, you know? Unfortunately, I'm still in pain like all the time, so that makes it harder because it's my reality now, and I know I can vaguely remember a life without pain, but not that well. The way that the chapter ends is with me looking at my life as this giant, like, cherry on top of this sundae that I didn't think that I would get to have. Because unlike a lot of people, I know what death looks like. I know it. I know those final seconds of what the end of my life looks like. And I know that I'm not supposed to be here. I know that. There's no good logical reason for why I'm alive. None. It is luck. And I do my best. I'm not always as grateful as I could be. I'm not like walking around on, like, you know, sparkle dust, but I feel all of my feelings truly and deeply. And when I say things, I mean it. And I do my best to make every person who I get to interact with, I want to make their life a little bit better for having me in it, or else there's no reason for me to be alive. That's sort of the way that the chapter ends, being grateful for the wonderful moments, but also the awful ones, because I'm alive to live them.
Special thanks to Katie McKenna for sharing her story. Katie has written a book, which was just released this week. Find out more about Katie and all the Arrivals guests by visiting our website, arrvls.com. Today's episode was sound designed and produced by me and edited by our associate producer, Nora Lind. Thanks, Nora. Our episode art is by Steph Tan. Arrivals is a founding member of the Herd Audio Collective, 8 independent producers from across North America who have banded together to share resources and to promote one another's work. I'm Jonathan Hirsch. Thank you for listening. And until we meet again, may you wind up where you need to be.